This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another.
Hey there, and welcome or welcome back to Practical for Your Practice. I'm Jenna Ermel, joined by the ever amazing Dr. Corinne Lefkowitz. Welcome, Corinne, as co-host today. Excited to be together as always.
Always, and I always enjoy being called amazing. So thanks, thanks for that. I'm glad to be here.
And it's recorded. You could play it over and over.
I plan to.
And over again. We have a fantastic guest that we're going to introduce today. But I'm also a little excited because guess what, Corinne?
What?
We have a question from one of our listeners.
Yes, finally.
I know. Yay. I know. We love questions from our listeners. And I'm pretty excited to be able to bring it to the podcast. Thank you for writing in. We had Amanda from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
And she wrote in and was wondering how we, she said, I'm really enjoying listening to the podcast. I listen to it on my walks. I've been wondering how you go about picking the topics and guests for your show. I think that's a great question.
Nice. Yeah.
I think it's evolved a little bit, and I'm going to go with initially, like in the first few seasons, it was kind of like, who do you know? Who are our colleagues? Who are our connections? Who do we like to talk to? Yeah. Who could we rope into this, you know, crazy idea of doing a podcast about evidence-based psychotherapy? And so we hit those folks, and then also then maybe looked at like what EBPs hadn't we covered, or what presenting problems hadn't we covered, or challenges, you know, clinical challenges hadn't we covered. So that's sort of when we got started with that.
Yeah, I would agree that that's really evolved, because I think now, for me at least, when I'm thinking about what I want to chat about on the podcast, so often it comes from a discussion or a question that I've had with either a participant at a workshop who's come in and asked a question that I hadn't thought about before, or a consultation session where somebody's brought an issue that either I never heard before or comes up all the time. And I think, I wonder if we can chat about that some more on the podcast.
That's I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think our feeling is if somebody's asking it in consultation, if somebody's asking it in a workshop, you know, there's other folks out there who might be grappling with that or struggling with that. So,
and hopefully if I find it interesting, then our listeners would too, right?
You would think. You would think. So great question. Thank you, Amanda, for reaching out to us. We would love to hear from other folks.
Yes.
So listeners out there, if you have a question, whether it's about a specific EBP or a topic you'd love to have us talk about on the podcast, even something from a previous guest, please do reach out to us. We would love to hear from you either on our SpeakPipe. You can leave us a message, or like Amanda, you can send us an email, which is listed in the notes there.
I think I would love to hear from listeners. And I would add that that question actually is really timely, because the topic that we're going to talk about today, at least for me, is something that comes up in workshops and consultation all the time. So it's actually the perfect question to segue us into today's episode.
Yes, our guest today is Kristen Hines. And Kristen is going to tell you more about her experience, but the topic we're going to talk about today is suicide and high-risk behaviors that might come up, suicidality that might come up when you're treating somebody via telehealth, talking about doing EBPs for suicide prevention via telehealth. This is something that our workshop attendees and consultees ask us all the time, the what-ifs around that. So Kristen, we're so happy to have you today. Thank you for joining us on Practical for Your Practice.
Yes, welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
And can you just maybe give us a little snapshot of who you are and a little bit about your work in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a licensed professional counselor. I have been licensed and practicing for like 10 years now. I've had kind of a diverse background. I've worked in nonprofits. I've also worked in a federally qualified health center. And then I spent about 8 years working for the Department of Veteran Affairs in various clinics, different settings, a lot of work in primary care mental health. And then most recently, I was offering suicide prevention telehealth, where we worked with individuals who were flagged as high risk and offered specific EBPs.
Thanks for that introduction. We really are excited to have you here. As I said, this is a topic and a concern that comes up so frequently in almost every workshop that I give. As soon as I start talking about telehealth, participants are asking the question, well, what would you do if? And so I guess one thing that I'm interested in knowing is how you got involved in this, how you got interested in this topic, and how you got to where you are now.
Yeah. You know, again, I've got like a variety of different like general mental health type experience. And so when the opportunity to do a little bit more specific work in suicide prevention came up, I was excited and applied for that position. I think there's such a need for it.
Yes.
You know, we hear about the statistics all the time as far as like suicide attempts go and suicide related behavior. So such a huge need for it. And I think for me, it was also an opportunity to build my confidence with working with higher risk individuals, because I think that's not something that we always get when we're in school or when we first get out and we're working. And so the opportunity to be able to have more experience, build those skills, and build my confidence as a clinician, that was really something I was looking forward to. And I had a really awesome experience when I was working that position. It was really, really rewarding and fulfilling and very enlightening to me in how I approach things and in my own work.
That's so wonderful to hear, because I think most of, I don't want to speak for all providers, but I think this is a topic sometimes we want to move away from or, you know, kind of escape. And you just like a prolonged exposure therapist that I am, I'm so proud. You just moved right towards it and said, I want to get more confident. I want to get more experience. And then to hear the success and how meaningful and you really enjoyed the work. So I love hearing that. And I think that's important for our listeners to hear too, because I think sometimes we do have this tendency to kind of go and step away or feel uncertain from
yes.
that. So.
And to be honest, it wasn't without my own anxiety. I mean, I think as providers, we all have that, a little bit of like hesitation, anxiety, nervousness when we're talking about risk. I think for me, some of that goes back to education, you know, hearing in class, like, oh, make sure you document appropriately and, you know, reliability reasons. And so I think that probably was part of it. And then just, you know, as we go, we don't always have a lot of exposure to assessing for suicide risk. And so, yeah, it was not without some anxiety that I moved into that, but it turned out to be a really good experience.
I don't know. I think that sounds kind of healthy, right?
Yeah.
Like, would you want to be anything less than a little bit anxious and a little bit concerned when you know you're going to be dealing with high risk patients with high risk behaviors and concerned about their safety? Seems like a healthy way actually to approach it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think too, one of the things we wanted to talk about, you know, obviously the face of telehealth changed dramatically during, or not the face of telehealth, but the use of telehealth changed dramatically during COVID. So even providers who maybe would have avoided this previously were kind of put into this position of, I've got to do this. I'm staying in practice. If I want to stay in this field, if I want to keep working with clients, I have to pivot. And I think there were some assumptions, maybe even some myths about telehealth that were really kind of tested during that period, during COVID-19, to include that high-risk patients were considered maybe inappropriate candidates for virtual care due to their risk or liability, as you said, that comes along with that. And that like maybe delivery of protocols like CBT for suicide prevention were inferior if you did it via telehealth versus in person. And I'm curious, if you could share a little bit about what do we know about that now? How has that view changed? How have we maybe even busted some of those myths or expectations?
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on part of it is we got to a point where it was like, okay, if we're going to engage in therapy, it has to be virtual.
Yeah.
In certain places, there was no chance to see people face to face. And so really learning to adapt And, you know, when we think about our military population, adapt and overcome, like we have to keep moving forward. We can't just not offer therapy services. And I think that that applies too with our suicide prevention therapies. We can't just not offer them if somebody is only able to do telehealth. And so figuring out how to address any kind of barrier that might come up, or even like, how do I shift my own practice? If I'm used to doing it face-to-face, what does it look like for me and the way that I like to present information if it's going to be virtually? I personally did not find that there were any additional barriers compared to just general telehealth. I mean, people have to be in a private location. They have to have the space for this where they can join the appointments. You know, the obvious guidelines of you can't be driving while you join, and, you know, you have to be someplace private, or, you know, fully dressed, or, you know, all of these things that we require anyways from telehealth. You know, this just, they transition over to telehealth for suicide prevention too. I think maybe where some people kind of get hung up is, again, this idea of risk of, what if somebody has a crisis and I'm not physically there, or they're not in my office? And I always kind of think back to, if I was in my office and someone was having a crisis and they got up and left my office, I'm not going to physically restrain them.
Right.
I'm going to call in for support. I'm going to call a welfare check if they have left the campus that I'm on, or, you know, I'm going to use those emergency services. And so it's, to me, the same concept, but just slightly different at a distance. So, and I think another important piece here is reviewing this with your patient when you see them as well, and saying, these are the parameters of our safety concerns. If you get to a point where you're telling me there's plan and intent and you're going to act on it, and you disconnect the call or something, I'm going to call in a welfare check. I'm going to have somebody come make sure that you're okay. Or another option is, maybe you guys discuss it and they're okay with you calling their emergency contact, their family member, their spouse, whoever it is that they might have. And so knowing that there are procedures in place that are going to be implemented if there's a concern that there's imminent risk. But I think a lot of it comes down to just having an open conversation with your patient about, like, this is what it looks like, and these are some safety nets that maybe we have to have in place.
The way you talk about that is so refreshing, because the way you started that answer is exactly the way that I see the issue, which is that providers or participants in our workshops or consultations, what they are concerned about is exactly what you just said. But what if the patient suddenly expresses some kind of thoughts about suicide, or what if the patient disconnects their call and I don't know what to do? As if it's unique, as if any of that is unique to telehealth. And the way you just so calmly described the fact that there's actually a lot more similarities between what you would do in a telehealth versus an in-person appointment is so refreshing and reassuring to hear. And was what I was hoping you were going to say, frankly.
As a practitioner of telehealth, yes.
Yes. I mean, a lot of it is the same. And I absolutely understand it. Again, it's not that I didn't have my own anxieties or reservations about offering this via telehealth, but the more I did it, the more I realized, like, this is just practice. This is what we do. This is, we see our patients, we assess every single person, no matter what, whether there's no history of suicide or whether there is a previous attempt or something. And we know, you know, as we build that therapeutic relationship, we know when something is different. And yeah, I'm assessing via screen instead of in person, but I'm still getting some of those cues from somebody. If they seem like they're more distressed, or if they're expressing different concerns, if their voice is different, you know, we have the ability to make that assessment through a screen as we do in person as well.
Is there anything specific for our listeners that you would recommend in terms of those screening tools? Anything that if our listeners wanted to get more confident and more practiced with this, what would you recommend for them?
You know, I think self-report measures can be really helpful. There is, you know, we use the Columbia. I think pretty much everybody's familiar with the Columbia as far as assessing risk that way, or a PHQ-9, or even the suicide cognition scale can be a really helpful one. But I think as far as building your confidence, it's practice, and it's, you know, real life experience. And one thing that I found to be really important for me, or, you know, something that made a big difference in how I offered these services, is building up my own confidence in asking these questions. I can think back to, you know, when I first started, when I was very, you know, newly licensed or limited licensed, and I was going out there and seeing patients and, you know, not have a lot of confidence in anything really at that point. But particularly when you're looking at risk, I would probably phrase things like, you know, more tentatively, like, mm-hmm. Have you had any thoughts of harming yourself? Or you're not thinking of suicide, are you? You know, kind of tentatively or leading.
I'm really sorry to ask this, but
I don't know. It's okay. You know, kind of like prefacing it.
Yeah.
And I think that what my experience allowed me to do is really confidently ask flat out, are you having thoughts of suicide? Mm-hmm. Have you thought of a plan of how you would do this? Do you have any intent to act on that plan? And I think in my ability to gain confidence in asking these questions to make this assessment, it allowed my patient to feel confident in giving me an answer. Yeah. So if I seemed uneasy or like uncomfortable, or like maybe I wouldn't be okay with their answer, they're probably not going to give me a straight answer. They're going to be like, no, this one, she doesn't seem like she wants to maybe hear it, or she's not confident. She doesn't know what to do with it. So, you know, they might be more reserved in their response to me. Whereas if I can show them that I'm totally comfortable having this very vulnerable conversation, that's a very difficult one to have. If I'm comfortable with it, you can be comfortable with giving me these answers.
Mm-hmm. And there might, I guess, need to be an element of faking it till you make it. I guess if you're at the beginning of your career, the beginning of doing this kind of work, faking it till you make it, so that you could project that confidence even if you don't completely feel it yourself.
Absolutely. And so I think for me, like having kind of a script or knowing how I want to ask the question was helpful, rather than just like going in and trying something out without thinking about it before. You know, and we offer a lot of that in our CBTSP training, is practice for introducing these things or how to ask these questions related to risk. And I think those are really helpful tools to build up that confidence. So when you do have somebody in your office who is reporting thoughts of suicide, or even like a history of an attempt, you feel a little bit better about asking some of those direct questions.
And that's actually a nice segue to talk a little bit more about that EBP. I know you also are trained in problem solving therapy. You know, maybe just like a tiny thumbnail sketch of what does CBTSP look like in telehealth? You know, is it fairly similar, things you do differently? You know, how has that played out for you? What do we know about, you know, again, I think one of the myths was like, that's much more effective if they're in person versus telehealth. Where do we stand with some of those things now that we have more experience with providing that in via telehealth?
Yeah, I mean, there's more research coming out that it's just as effective to offer via telehealth as it is in person. So that's always reassuring to have some empirical evidence for that. But even in my own personal experience, I didn't find, unless somebody is like inherently opposed to telehealth, regardless of what the topic is, most people are really open to it and find that it's a really helpful thing. I think one of the huge benefits of this is it has opened up availability for people. There are so many people that I saw that would go out to their car at lunch, and that's where we would have their appointment, that otherwise they would not have been able to engage in this therapy. And we can't be withholding these therapies just because somebody can't come into the office. And so again, in my experience, offered a lot more opportunity for people to access these services, people in rural communities who otherwise couldn't make it into a clinic. So it's just as valuable. There are definitely some more barriers. So, you know, CBT, we love our homework pages and our handouts. And sometimes hard when we're virtual. So if you have a way to send something virtually to somebody, email, secure message, whatever platform you're using, that is an option. Mailing things is also an option. If somebody prefers a paper copy, getting, you know, a packet of handouts mailed out to them can also be another option. You know, CBTSP, we do a couple of different things. You know, we do the crisis narrative timeline. And so if we can like share our screen and kind of fill that out with that person as they're going, that's another way to eliminate that barrier of them not seeing it right in front of them. But yeah, essentially, you know, in CBTSP, we are we're doing safety planning, we're talking about risk assessment, we are treatment planning, going through this crisis narrative, and then building skills that are going to help address these thoughts of suicide and hopefully prevent another crisis from happening. So we talk about behavioral skills, affective coping skills, and cognitive skills. And then we're also going to have a late phase of treatment where we're wrapping it all up and we're talking about, okay, we've learned these things. How can we apply them in future scenarios? Or how do you use these new skills to deal with stressors as they arise? So it's a great therapy, I think. I've seen a lot of success myself with it. And sometimes we kind of have to gauge what success looks like. You know, it might not be that you're never going to have another thought of suicide again. It might just be that it's less intense or less frequent, or the duration is less, or, you know, there's no other escalation to an attempt. The thoughts are more mild or more moderate.
We always love to include, I think many of us learn and understand things well through stories. And obviously we're not talking case examples with identifiable information, but wondered if you had thought of any stories either of, you know, when things went sideways and you were trying to do this via telehealth, or a story of, you know, anyone you want to tell, really. Did you happen to have any? And if you don't, that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, as far as when things go sideways, this is technology, and it does not matter how well versed you are in it. Something's going to happen inevitably.
Totally.
This is life. Somebody's internet's going to drop, power goes out, whatever it might be. Phones die. I have found that pretty frequently, that when somebody's doing a video appointment on their phone is likely going to die. And so knowing that if they disconnect and the screen goes black and you try to call and you can't reach them, like, okay, don't panic. It's okay. Their phone probably died. So giving them a few minutes to charge it, giving them a call back and picking up where you left off. So kind of just like rolling with some of these things that come up with technology. But again, a lot of success stories. One that sticks out for me is when I look at therapy, there's a couple ways, again, to gauge success. And I think there's the quantitative way of looking at, you know, changes in scores and decrease in like symptom rating. But I think like to me, the qualitative aspect of that is what's really important. And so I had somebody who just really did well, very committed, weekly appointments, kept with everything, did their homework, really stuck with it. And at the end of treatment, there was a big decrease in those self-report measures, which is awesome to see. But more importantly to me was she mentioned that she was able to reestablish relationship with her family, her immediate family. Mm. So a sister and her parents. And she felt very isolated and very disconnected. She thought they were disappointed in her, that they didn't want anything to do with her because of this history of suicide behavior. And so for her to be able to say, I reached out, we had this conversation, I was able to challenge these unhelpful thought patterns, I knew that they weren't mad at me, and now I have this relationship again. To me, that is the most meaningful change, because we know things can be statistically significant, but that doesn't mean they're meaningful. Hearing that meaningful personal change from somebody, I think, is what is most rewarding from this type of therapy.
That's huge.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it kind of those social connections and building those outside of therapy, real, you know, social connections, or reestablishing them or repairing them. That's a great story. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. That one sticks out to me the most. Cause again, you know, there's obviously measures and that's great and that looks good on paper, but hearing that change and knowing that personally, it made such a difference for her. You know, that's why we do it.
Jenna, that actually reminds me of a conversation that we had last season with Joe Ruzek. We were talking about group therapies for PTSD, and not that we need to rehash the whole conversation, but one of the main points that we talked about in that episode is that positive results are more than just a score on a PCL5 or a PHQ9 or a BDI or whatever. They're about how has a person's life changed. And importantly, one of the important pieces of that is what connections do they have and are they able to maintain? So Kristen, I love your story because that's just another example of it. And, you know, Dr. Ruzek was talking about group therapies. You're talking about SP, suicide prevention via telehealth. And yet the potential outcome is the same, the potential positive outcome. That's really exciting to hear.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to like treatment goals too, right? Like if a treatment goal was to make more connections or to feel less isolated, awesome. We've done it. Yeah. And that is what's really important.
Yeah. Well, it sticks out to me that what you've been talking about today really fits in with our theme for this season. So you may have heard that our theme for season 6 of our podcast is Who's Got Your Six? Who's got your back in times of crisis, whether that be personal or professional? It's clear to me that you, Kristen, have a lot of people's backs in doing the work that you do, right? Also, the work that you do especially requires you to be supported as well and to have people who have your six or who have your back. So wonder if you'd share with us whether somebody comes to mind who's had your six, either personally or professionally. And I'll say that our rule for this is that we're not going to name names because then people get mad at you because you didn't name them when they listen right. to your episode. So don't give us any identifying information, but does anybody stand out to you as somebody who has had your six?
Absolutely. I don't think that you can be a mental health professional without support in mm-hmm. your own clinic or other professional support, because it is such a unique challenge to meet people every day and address their problems and help them through what they're going through and then process your own stuff while you're going through that as yeah. well. Mm-hmm. You can't do it alone. This is not something that you can just on your own coast through it all and be fine. And so I absolutely in my career have encountered some really incredible clinicians who have offered just, I don't even know how to describe how helpful the consultation has been or the ability to process through things. We've all had, we've all had these uncomfortable moments with our patients where maybe something is like misread or misconstrued, or they're just upset and they take it out on you. And I have mm-hmm. absolutely, I can think of like one specific instance in my head where there was just this kind of run-in with somebody that I had been seeing, and they were upset and they, you know, were swearing at me and it kind of throwing some insults my way, and, you know, and then abruptly hung up. It was a phone call and then that was it. And yikes. It's like, okay, well that felt so horrible. And being able to reach out to, I'm thinking of one colleague in particular that I could be like, I need like 10 minutes. If you can just give me like 10 minutes, I have to talk with you about what just happened because I'm trying to make sense of it myself. And I'm having a really hard time, because those types of instances can make you question your own clinical judgment or clinical mm-hmm. skills. Like, what did I do? Am I wrong? Am I misreading this? Did I do something to trigger this? And so being able to process that with my coworker helped me so much for her to say like, no, this isn't you. It's okay. It'll get sorted out. It was, you know, a misunderstanding of some sort. Give it an hour. Maybe try calling back or ask somebody else on the treatment team to call, you know, brainstorming ideas of how to handle that, but also how to kind of reassure me that yeah. this one bad experience doesn't mean that like I'm a bad clinician or I don't know what right. I'm doing.
Right. We've talked about, Jen and I have talked about that when we come to, well, let me put it a different way. The colleagues whom we trust the most with having our sixes mm-hmm. are the colleagues that maybe have known us for a while. So actually have a fair amount of data points about us so that like in those moments that you're describing, when you have one bad conversation, they can remind you, hey, this is one conversation out of many that right. I've heard you have or I've observed. Would that be fair to say from your perspective as well, Kristen?
Yes. Again, we fall into these unhelpful thinking patterns ourselves yeah. as well, don't we?
Just like our clients. Yes. yes. As you're saying that, I'm like, it sounds exactly like somebody we might, you know, try to point that out to. And
exactly. Like catastrophizing, yeah. all or nothing thinking. Right. Yeah. We're all yeah. there. And so being able to have another person in your field who knows what you're doing, who knows you as a clinician,
yes.
Knows your skill set, being able to kind of like talk you down a little bit, like no, yeah, let's sure. challenge this thought. Is right. there proof for it? What is the evidence against it? So that is incredibly helpful. And again, for anybody in mental health, I think you need that support, but especially if you're working with individuals who are maybe at a higher risk for suicide,
yes.
being able to process some of this stuff with somebody is so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fantastic. It's a great example of Got Your Six in a very meaningful way with this topic. It sometimes maybe feels like the stakes are just a little higher in this area. So I'm glad to hear that you have a community of providers who can offer that to you. We, as I mentioned, we've talked about before, we always end with actionable intel. So that our listeners, those providers, can walk away with maybe some things that they can take forward.
Incoming actionable intel.
And you've already mentioned some great ones, so I'm going to throw them out, and then you can add additional ones if you'd like. But so far, we've heard you say, you know, screeners are helpful. Using screeners can be good in your practice. The importance
we'll
of sound.
Those, if I may, we'll
yes,
link those
yes.
ones that Kristen mentioned in our show notes, so folks have
Thank
access
you.
To them.
Thank you, Corinne. That ability to sound confident and build confidence and sound confident. So even if you're not quite there, finding ways, even if that's, I think, as you said, sort of scripting something so that you have a way to ask these questions with confidence and continue to build that as time goes on is really important. Don't go it alone. We hear this very consistently. Have support in the work that you're doing. Get consultation when you need it. And I'm gonna throw another one out there, which is get some training in an evidence-based protocol for suicide prevention. Are there any other actionable intel items that you would want our listeners to have at the ready, or resources that were particularly helpful to you that we can link in the show notes?
Definitely, to reiterate, get the training. It's there. We're
offering
it here. Yeah, at CDP, we offer it. I'm helping out with a lot, so maybe I'll see you. And also, we have consultation for CBTSP as well. So you complete the training, you still have questions about implementation, come to the consultation. It's there. That's what it's there for. Please use it. I think a lot of it comes down to kind of assessing your own anxieties and where those are coming from, building up that confidence, getting some training wherever you can, and whatever you can, safety planning, lethal means counseling, the full CBTSP training. Ask for help, because it's there and we should use it.
Well said. Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for this discussion today. As I said, I feel like it's incredibly relevant to our listeners, because it's question that comes up all the time in our workshops and consultation, and you've actually made it really user-friendly and straightforward to try to explain it and try to ease providers' anxieties, I'll say, to the extent that they should be,
It's always going to be a little scary, always going to have a little anxiety, but I think, again, some of that can be mitigated with building up your skill set.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Jenna, thank you for another great episode, for allowing me to join you.
I feel really lucky to have, to get to be here today and hear all this wisdom. And, hopefully you out there, listeners, found something useful today. You'll follow us on your favorite platform.
You'll send us questions and feedback about things that you want to hear us talk about next.
And most importantly, you're going to be sure to stay curious and...
Jenna, mind your EBPs.
See you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.